It'd be all interesting, but any specific instances that might be of interest to a child reading the book. This will be for teenagers. It won't be for little children. And for adults, too.
Yes, I mean,
for instance, I do have the one instance, I've read it, where a landing party was pursuing the enemy back, the Japanese back, and our lines had gone farther than the ship thought they had, and they were bombarding our lines. Mm-hmm. And they kept sending messages back, you're bombarding your own lines. Japanese have retreated. And they thought that the Japanese were making this up. And so they said, do you have a Navajo? And they said, yes. And so the Navajos then talked and said, and after this message got through that this was true, then the artillery went over farther and into the Japanese lines. I just wonder if you can think of anything similar to that kind of thing.
No, not we didn't have any of those things happen in our operation.
Yours is more or less routine.
Everything went according to Hoyle.
Well, that's good.
You didn't get into a big crisis.
No foul up.
No snafu.
Like after our New Zealand retraining and all that re-equipment and stuff, we move on to Tarawa. Some call it Tarawa. Some call it Bishio Atoll. Anyway, it's just
Tarawa is what I've heard.
I think the name of the island used to be Helen Island too. That's where we stormed ashore, and that's what made the history. Is to be one of the bloodiest on the Pacific, 72-hour operation.
Were you with the group that went ashore?
Yes, we was one of the earlier waves. That's about the only place on the area on the Pacific where I really got my head knocked off, so to speak. Got too far into the front line. This one lieutenant we had as a squad leader or platoon commander, kept pushing us to go. So that's all we could do is just obey and keep going. And we discovered that we were right between the crossfires, the enemy, and we saw some Marines all scattered around, you know, ducked in and so forth. Here we were, just came off these rubber boats. That rubber boat that we came ashore on, got punctured, you know, in the water, they had those things sticking out.
Yeah.
Water was kind of down, the tide wasn't up, so I guess one of them punctured it. Boy. We had just had to try to go so far, you know, and then we just had to wade ashore the rest of the way. Anyway, I fell into this one shell hole, and there was a Japanese laying there.
Alive? Lord,
no, just had been shot, I guess, but looked like he was real, you know, alive. Well, I was just hoping and praying that he don't stab me or come out with something. All the time that we were pinned down. But after a while, what seemed like hours, you know, they finally cleared the way and we were able to get out of that position.
You were not asked in that during that time to send a message.
No, we had the headquarters group were the ones. See, we were just attached to a unit then.
Yes.
And that way, but after we all got off the ships, of course we all assembled there and told of all these incidents that we came across, the Navajo boys, that is. So, after we secured the island, of course, we had to leave and go back to Hawaii, the big island in Hawaii. We set up camp there. We called it Camp, I believe the name was Kamauela, was the name of the area, Camp Kamauela. But later they changed it to Camp Tarawa. And of course, when the Submarine Division was ready to make a spearhead into Saipan Tinian operation, before that, about 18 of us got pulled out of that to go to Oahu near Pearl Harbor. There was a rest camp there. I don't know why they pulled me along with the group. They must think I was needed recuperating.
You look tired.
Anyway, we spent a couple months over there. Meantime, my outfit moved on to Saipan, Tinian.
And you didn't get to go with
them? I didn't get to go. When what they figure enough time for us there, they sent us back. By that time, the 5th Marine Division had just pulled off Iwo Jima. They were at our camp. And we rejoined them there. And then they had some code talkers in there, so I joined back with them, and we trained there again. We go every day, these TBXs, you know, these junky radios.
And this was the 5th Division.
Yes. So we were all set, and of course, I guess all the big planners were planning to invade Japan itself. This was the what we were being readied for. So, of course, we all got combat load and everything. Away we went on our way to Japan. About halfway over somewhere past the Iwo Jima vicinity. The sound of VJ, peace talks. So, but we went ahead with the operation as planned. Nothing was changed. The only thing was that we're not to fire one shot. So, the area that our group hit was just on Kyushu Island. That's one of the southern part of the Japan itself, where they had one of the larger naval base, Japan. And we went to this one bay where we were to storm ashore, but we could have probably just been floating around out there the way they had that, around the edge of the bay, you know, it was all walled, about as high as the door above the water. Certain place they had ramps, and all around there in the hills they come in like this. It was all gun emplacements. So when we went in there, they could have just.
So you didn't go.
But we went ashore there, and we went up to where the ramps were, you know, and boats, and landing boats, and there we walked ashore, you know, and march on over to this naval base. That's where we camped for about 3 months.
Well, these gun emplacements didn't come alive then. This
was after peace treaty.
After
VJ.
This was while they were on the way.
Yeah.
They sounded the.
Oh, yes. Not to shoot,
yes.
I know that.
So all these Japanese had left.
They had left their gun emplacement.
They went for the high ground. See, that's where, after about 2 weeks later, they start coming down. Mm-hmm. A few at a time. Finally, in about a month's time, there most of them had come back down to the villages and they were going by their business. You know, of course, when we go, when I look around, we had to carry our own water and everything, lunch. Their weapons around. And then after about 3 months, of course, they called for all personnel that had been out overseas the longest. They used to go by a point system then.
Mm-hmm.
So I had been out about 28 months. I was one of the first to go, come back. And we learned later that the skipper that maneuvered this transport back with us, he was getting out too, so he had made a kind of a side trip around near the Aleutians.
Gave him a
lecture. 19 days to come back down to San Diego. So up in the Aleutians, you know, we saw a lot of whales, you know. Yeah. Oh, it was cold up there.
You'd rather come home,
Oh, but he's been to the Aleutians now, though.
Use blankets, you know, to even stand the chow. We used to go up on the top and then come down. Then they made a passage through the passageway to go to the mess hall on the ship. It was cold up there. And we're going to come into Seattle, but this was near Navy Day. So all the ships had come in, you know, all the ports along the West Coast. So the only place we had to come in was San Diego.
And where you started from.
And of course, not too long after that, we were all discharged. About November, I guess, 45. And I head straight out to a place called Lawrence, Kansas, Haskell Institute. And I applied for this GI training. I wanted to finish my high school. See, I had left just finishing my ninth grade out of shipwreck. But after, this was in November, about February the following year, 46, I got kind of restless. And they had put me in a sophomore class. And there, of course, they gave us books, you know, they just happened to be reading about China and some of those areas out there, you know. I wanted to go out there instead of just reading about it. So another buddy and I, we went to Kansas City and we re-enlisted over there in the Marine Corps. So sure enough, after I got back to California, he sent me all the way out to China. The 1st Marine Division was there then. They were occupational forces there. So I joined up with the headquarters battalion, 1st Signal Company. So I was still with communication.
Yeah.
See, once they brand you with that communication, you're stuck with it. Well, I had a heck of a time trying to change it, but I never did.
Well, did you enjoy it? I think you would enjoy that, that particular area.
Well, they put me on this detached assignment with the Army. They call the ceasefire team. They were way up North China, Peiping, up in that area. So I took a radio jeep and all my what little supplies I had, my own personal. Went up there and worked with the Army up there. They were mostly colonels and lieutenant colonels, you know. that one barracks that they all stayed in, they used to call it the Temple of a Thousand Colonels. We worked up there on toward the all the way up to the Great Wall, from there down. And I was communicator in contact with the division headquarters there, Pei Ping, and their own army there. And then, of course, just by that time, the communists were beginning to activate their forces up there. So eventually they pushed us out of there and we moved back down to Tientsin, China. It was a little south from Peiping. And of course later they pushed us all the way back down to Tsingtao. And all these times, of course, we were in training. And code talking, we just plumb forgot that, you know, I was in a regular communication business then.
They didn't use a code talking over there at all.
No. And I guess the largest net that I've been on was what they call Pacific Net. We were in contact with Guam and some unit in Shanghai, and then China, and one other location. These are all wireless key type of communication. I don't think so. And after spending about 2 years, of course, I came back. Well, two times there, while I was stationed over there, I came back as a rifle and pistol shooter. See, that was another area I got interested in. I got to the highest accomplishment you can get in there is individual marksmanship, distinguished, they call it. That's in all phases of the military. You either get distinguished with a rifle or a pistol. So that's what I did after competing with other Marines from other units in the Pacific area there at Pearl Harbor.
Isn't it true that the Indians were particularly good at marksmanship? That's
if they weren't drinking, they were good. I stayed away from that. I know one Navajo boy that came out with me from China. He died after he got out in an auto accident. And he likes his liquor, boy. He'd go out. And I told him, I says, you're going to have to stay away from that. You want to get back to the States. Because the only ones that will make the team is these medal winners. See, they used to put out maybe two or three gold medals and five or six silver and maybe 8 or 10 bronze. And shooters that win these are the only ones eligible to make up a team representing the Pacific area. Plus those that are distinguished, you know, they can either go or not if they want to. So we used to go through all this training, dry run, snapping in, they call it. My God, he almost beat me out. He was about 1 point behind me. So we came back, and of course, once we're in the States, we didn't have to worry about trying so hard. So out of California, he used to go down San Diego and wind up way down in Mexico, Tijuana. Get drunk all he can. And then they used to, I guess they still do, they hold their, what they call Western Division matches there. At, it used to be at Camp Matthews, that's right next to Camp Elliott. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's all, is it Southern California?
Yes, I think it is.
University. Mm-hmm. Now it's all Camp Pendleton. They hold their matches there, Western Division matches. And all the winners, they go to Eastern, Quantico, Virginia. They hold their Marine Corps matches there. And then all the winners from there, of course, later, they begin going to Camp Perry. It's kind of like World Series of the shooters.
Did you win out down
there? Oh, yes, I won some all through. And last time I shot there was, I guess, around about 56. That's when I injured my back, and that was it. Couldn't do any more of those, go into those strenuous positions, you know.
Well, now, look, we don't want to take any more. He's a busy man. We don't want to take.
No, I'm not too busy.
We're having a wonderful time.
Yeah. The only thing we have to go back and pick up these now. These copies over in Mr. Claw's office. Did you have some questions?
Well, I was just wondering if did the Navajo boys tend to exchange experience as much when they got together?
After the war,
after
you mean?
No.
This is they want to forget them.
This is what Mr. McKen is trying to do. He, of course, no one's really given that a thought until this Chicago event. And then he's laid on to several of the boys that were there, of course, after they got back over here. They try to rouse interest among some of the others, but no, they don't want no part of it. In fact, they never really elaborate on some of these things. I don't know why.
Do they want to forget the experiences they've had?
I suppose.
There's a tendency for that, I think.
Because
my dad always said, I remember him saying it at one particular time, that his boy, you know, meaning me, he never said anything about what he did overseas or in his service, you know. Never told. This was after I got back. Of course, when I was still in, I wrote letters, you know, and all that. Mm-hmm. And I really don't. Of course, nobody really asks about it. So I just.
But the polls.
I just feel that, you know, that nobody's really interested in it. And
well, I, in order to get into the feeling of the whole thing, I read Guadalcanal Diary,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
and another book called This Was Your War, and it's terrible, really. It was just a terrible thing. I mean,
anybody involved in that probably wanted to forget.
And that's
remember.
Well, not just the kind of thing you're falling into this hole and finding a dead Jap there. You know, that's not a pleasant.
Well, they used to just cover them wherever they laid, you know, especially very rarely we have a hot meal, and they call us over in one area, and we go over there in our mess kits and get served, and we'd have to sit on something mushy, and here they'd be dead bodies. The stench, man. You just have to live with it.
In talking to Mr. Johnston, see, Mr. Johnston lived on the reservation from the time he was four.
Mm-hmm.
And he spoke fluent, still speaks fluent Navajo, and he's had a lot of experience. And he told us the other day that, of course, the tribe is so enlightened now, and there's so much education that they don't think as they used to, excepting probably some of the very elderly ones. Mm-hmm. But when he was a little boy, they were very afraid if mm-hmm. they were close to a dead body. Mm-hmm. And they thought there was a spirit mm-hmm. that would strangle them or something, you know. Now, mm-hmm. this was years ago. Mm-hmm. But I wondered, you know, sometimes these things trickle down through the generations and we have certain feelings. Did the mm-hmm. Navajo men, did they have any fear? Like this, of the dead bodies that they had to...
Mm-hmm. Well,
more than the Caucasians, more than the whites.
Apparently not, because those that I served with, you know, they didn't care one way or the other. They just...
Mm-hmm. This was just war, and this
everybody
just
else. Of course, after they returned, most of them had this ceremonial for them. They call it the score dance.
Tell me about that.
This is more or less to purify individual from any contact with an enemy. This began way back when, I guess, when the Navajos used to raid these other tribes around the area, mm-hmm. or fought with the cavalry and other troops around. Those were the enemies. Anyone shooting arrows at them.
Sure.
So when they contact that, they were to have this ceremony for them. It's kind of like a purification, curative type ceremony. Runs 3 days and 3 nights. And whatever part of an enemy that they brought back, this was used. If it's the hair or a piece of the clothing, that was used. And a certain part of the ceremony, it's taken out away. And it's buried there with ashes and shot at with a gun, a rifle. This is to show that it's
gone.
Up, yeah.
It's in the past.
Did you bring, did the boys tend to bring back for that?
Yes, just for this very purpose. I know I brought some hairs back and they used it. They had ceremony for me.
Is this an individual ceremony? I mean, for one person?
Yes.
Not a group, just one person, a squad dance. Now, who takes part in a ceremony like that?
Mostly relatives. And that's within the confine of the medicine man, whatever he has to administer to the patient and so forth. Just the relatives are... Well, there, of course, outside of the this enclosure, usually a hogan, you have the general public out there.
And anybody
they all
can
take,
come.
They all take part out there.
Oh.
That's more of a kind of a social type of dances, but it's also part of the ceremony here. Mm-hmm. So.
Does this still go on?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
It's still part of the...
It's a summer... In fact, they already had a couple as early as February, first part of February this year.
Of course, you're having veterans now, the Vietnamese War, aren't you?
Well, yes, they still have those. Whenever they return, they'll have these dances each and... Mm-hmm. Of course, it depends on the individual himself. If he doesn't want to, they just won't bother.
Mm-hmm.
But they seem to think that it'll eventually bother him, either physically or visually or mentally.
Do you think it really does help?
I don't know.
Psychological.
I never felt the effects or anything. In fact, on my account, quite a few of them were jailed for drinking.
you had something else on your conscience. Well, I would think that this psychologically might make a fellow forget and disentangle himself from some of the experience.
I think so.
And the fact that all of his family are with him. I should think that it would be
a reuniting.
Yes. This came up, something like this, in conversation the other day, and I said to him, you know, it wouldn't be a bad idea for us who have different ideas to have some sort of a ceremony in times of sorrow and so forth, where we have a feeling that everybody is on our side and want to help us and to help us forget all of the sadness.
See, one thing, our so-called leaders that are up here, or members of Navajo tribe, more particularly during 68 when they were celebrating the
centennial.
Yes. No one thought of the Navajo servicemen, particularly if they thought Code Talker were so important that time. Nobody even brought it up until the 4th Marine Division. See, they each year for the last 20 some odd years now have been honoring
22
certain ones in their organ, in their division. Maybe a corpsman, maybe a doctor, maybe CEO, or maybe someone killed. And just so happened last year it was Code Talkers.
Yes, Lee Cannon.
That served with that division. There were 15 of them. So instead of just honoring those boys, they thought it would be best, you know, to invite those that serve with the other divisions. This is where we came in.
Oh, yes, you were not in the 4th Division. You were in the 2nd Division.
See, I was with the 2nd, I was with the 5th, and I was with the 1st.
That's right. Well, I remember his saying, of course, I read all about the reunion, and he's told me representatives came from the other divisions, but since it was the 4th Marine Division reunion, but then they had a larger group of their own.
They could only have 10 contact and were able to attend. So in place of the other 5, they picked one more from each of the other.
Yes.
So there was 2 from each.
Right.
Yeah. So there was 20 of us that went there.
You don't know any talkers that would be in range of Wonder Rock, do you? That might also have a
maybe just a 10-minute or 15.
Well, Carl Gorman is one.
He's left.
He is.
He's gone back to California.
He's done a good job.
And
Mr. House.
Eugene Crawford.
Now that's a name I do not have. Where does he?
He works with heavy equipment up here at Fort Defiance.
We're going to Fort Defiance.
You come
tomorrow
to the junction. You go north to the toward the sawmill. About a mile or so after you leave the junction, there's a huge development there. You go into one of those turns off is a heavy equipment. He's there, Eugene Crawford.
Eugene Crawford. Well, maybe I could call him.
And then John Benali. He's, of course, working with the BIA Roads Department.
Yes. We're going to call him. Now, these Mr. House suggested, and then Peter McDonald.
No.
No.
I mean, this is the original group I'm referring
to. Oh, I see.
Of course, he may have been later, but I never knew or met him out there.
So. Okay. Is it Thomas Begay?
He was with the later group, but he's Chin Lee.
Well, then Eugene
Crawford. He's the one that Mr. McCann is trying to work through to organize something out here.
Mm-hmm.
And
Mr. House was trying to think of people, and he said, well, he's not very cultured. I said, we don't care. If a man is, of course, a man culturated.
Culturated.
And no, he, the thing is, if we could, for some, it's much, yes, it's very easy to talk with you because you have risen to a high position and you've been with a lot of people and you just talk to us across the board as he and I would talk. But it might be that some of these people would be afraid that their English is not good and so forth. Mm-hmm. We don't care. Mm-hmm. If they could just say, well, I served on Saipan and I served as a...
Or Navajo to work with us, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that would... Mm-hmm. That
to give them a feeling that we're not trying to take advantage of
them. We're not trying to... Mm-hmm. I know they have been exploited so many times, and we're, what I want to do is to honor the Navajos for what they've done in this particular...
See, if you want up at Mini Farms, NCC, there's a Peter Sandoval there.
Yes, now that name was mentioned to us today, and he's in guidance. And yes. I think he is at a conference for guidance people at Ann Arbor, Michigan, about 60 miles from where we live.
He's there next week, we'll see him.
We're going to go to drive over and try to see him. Now, the names that have been given to us, there are Peter McDonald, John Benally, Judge Dean Wilson, Thomas Begay. And where does he live?
He's head of maintenance department. He's right adjacent to Crawford over there.
At Fort Defiant. Mm-hmm. Now, what is his name again?
Frank Thompson. He lives all over here.
Well, we decided.
See, I think I got his number, 5702.
Now, 5702, is that the full number?
729 prefix. That's 45.
I see.
You can dial it from here.
Yeah, 729, 5702. Very good. Now, you wouldn't have Eugene Crawford's number, but we could find it in the telephone book.
Yes, it's heavy equipment, motor pool. In the phone book.
All right. Now, Mr. Link said that he would like very much if we could get a group of these people just to come down to the museum and just sit around the table and so that not one person would have to talk like you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're used to it, but some of these people might feel a little more at home. But I wonder if maybe Mr. Link might help us on this, Wilson, and get some
of these. I gave him one of the original pictures that they took of us at boot camp, this verse 29. They were trying to gather some materials for what they call capsule, the long barrel. And they were going to put all this in there and bury it over here somewhere.
Yes.
And I always raised one of the biggest stink over there.
Did they?
So he's just gonna leave it down here somewhere. I don't know.
Were they superstitious about it or something?
If it's still there or not, or place it in an archive or something, you know.
Yes.
But I think Navajo Times last year borrowed that picture from him. They use it in the Navajo Times.
I've seen several editions of the Navajo Times before and after the.
But. I had a negative made out of that, and I had one enlarged that big. So I still have the negative somewhere.
I wonder if I could get a picture from it.
Of that?
Just for the book. I'm getting a lot of pictures.
Or if you just borrow the negative, or else get a picture.
Well, if you leave me your address, I'll probably
send
will.
Give him your card, Wilson. Do you have one?
I can locate that film. Negative, rather.
You just write there.
My name on the back.
My name on the back,
because
this is my
question. It's the last one. All right.
I didn't think you replenished for their tone of the low.
I must have some cards made myself. Okay. I do have some, but they're. I used to be in a little. I my background is music and writing, and I managed a pianist, and so it was Doris Paul managed.
And I take part in their dances, and of course around here, Albuquerque, Ignacio, Colorado, Shiprock, Gallup, and some of these other areas around the reservation, they hold in the dances, they call it powwow, each weekend. And we all go over there, take part, dance, sing.
Forrest Coggin.
Never heard the name.
But he's been very interested in dance and preservation. Some with Michigan. And he's been down here with somebody at the University of Arizona who is. They have an organization that's trying to get money for this type of thing.
Well, there, the Indian club there. Thank you.
My husband is on the other side.
They call it Dawa Chindi Indian Club. But I don't know if they're even active now. They used to hold annual dances there at the school. And Tempe used to have, Tucson used to have theirs too.
And this man is really going into it seriously and trying to have foundations and so forth.
Yes, he's trying to get just incorporated in
international
free Teatro International is the organization.
And when he found I was coming down with the Navajos, he said, "They are my beloved people."
And actually, I'm not on their board, but actually, I'm listed as a
patron and advisor. See, my husband at the university.
National Folk Festival several years now, and I have been receiving this annual Burl Ives Award. And they have always asked me to serve on their what they call advisory capacity.
It's very expensive.
I know.
You know, it's costing us around $500 or so to come down just to get this material. And
poor college professor.
And I won't make much money off the book.
Well, I hope it's worth your.
Oh, it certainly has. I think we got.